Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A new PBS American Masters documentary directed by filmmaker and professor Yaruba Richin looks at the long history of black women in film, television, and music, and how women fought not only to be seen, but to be seen on their own terms. The doc follows the career trajectories of six entertainment greats: Lena Horne, Abby Lincoln, Nina Simone, Diane Carroll, Cicely Tyson, and Pam Grier, and highlights the close relationship between creative output and political awakening in the 20th century. What emerges from this documentary is a moving narrative that looks at how black women in entertainment have historically been tasked with shaping public perception while simultaneously challenging it. Richin's film is titled How It Feels to Be Free, and it premieres on 13 and PBS stations nationwide on MLK Junior Day this coming Monday, January 18th at 9 p.m. And I'm so pleased that Yaruba could join us. Yaruba, thanks for being with us. Nice to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
So your film looks at the professional arcs of six women, and the film has a chronology to it because each of these women represent a different era and some of the challenges of that particular era. Let's start with Miss Lena Horne. When she started out, what were Lena Horne's options?
When Lena Horne started out, there were not many options for her in the Hollywood industry. I mean, she was a groundbreaker. When she came to Hollywood after her singing career, after launching her singing career, most famously at Cafe Society and a club in L.A., where she was discovered by the Hollywood, by the Hollywood studios. She came and she negotiated a contract that said that she would not play maids or, as her daughter says, people in the jungle, which is really what the only options were for African-American women in Hollywood. So those were her options, and she defied that, and she created other options for herself, and really set the stage for African-American entertainers that and actresses that came after her.
What was the most persistent problem specifically for her?
Well, as she, the thing about our history, as we see right in front of us now, and definitely see in the entertainment industry, we make some strides, right? And then things retract and we have to and go back. And that's the history of, African-Americans in this country and of the entertainers as well. So she makes this breakthrough, negotiates this breakthrough contract. But what it ultimately means is that she's not cast in anything that's needy. She says, and she, says throughout her, the interviews that she did reflecting on her career, that she was reduced to a butterfly pinned to a column singing away in Hollywood. She only had, one or two speaking roles, and she was just reduced, and she was cut out of films, all the films when they were shown in the South. Because they could not, it was not acceptable for a black woman, a beautiful black woman, to play anything other than the maid in the South. And the South was one of their biggest markets. So, I mean, it was what she had to deal with. Then she also had to deal with the backlash from other black entertainers who had been doing had those maid roles and those servant roles, because they felt that if she didn't do it, she said she wasn't going to do it. Well, what were they saying about the roles that they were taking, and would there be any more roles for them? So she was getting at it from, she was getting, hit from all sides.
You give a great deal of context in the film for these women's struggles by interviewing historians and academics. I want to play a clip from your film. This is film critic Radian Samanpile, I think I'm pronouncing that right, discussing the roots of racism in the film industry in the United States.
The foundations of film are much like the foundations of America. Like, in the same way that America was built on slavery, film was built on racist imagery. the film that is largely credited as teaching us how to make films is Birth of a Nation. This was D.W. Griffith's epic recreation of the Civil War era. It's a movie that was built off the racist imagery from society, but then it in turn fed society by inspiring the second coming of the KKK.
That is from Eureka Richens' film, How It Feels to Be Free. So that was the world that Lena Horne was walking into. She also had, you know, and it's, I don't like this phrase particularly, but she sort of alludes to it in the film in some of the interviews, a little bit of the tragic mulatto issue, where she's not quite black enough for some people and she's too black for other people.
Yep. And again, that's the long trajectory of, you know, our experience as black women, or black women's experience in Hollywood. And she definitely had that. I mean, that's one of the stereotypes that Hollywood cast us, the tragic mulatto, right? Don't, you know, you don't know you're mixed. You don't know you're mixed racially and you're mixed up in the head. You don't know, you know, if you're too black or too white, no one accepts you and it's tragedy. And she had that perception in that the industry didn't want her to really, you know, she was too light to perform with other black actors. And so they darkened her up, literally. Max Factor created a makeup for her to wear to be dark, you know, to be darker. And then, of course, she couldn't be in movies with white people because that was unacceptable. You know, we really have to look at the foundations of Hollywood and the foundations of, you know, the racist and stereotypes that Hollywood created. And it's why, you know, this fight is still ongoing till today.
I want to talk about Abby Lincoln. She is fascinating. And you start the film with her describing how she was given one of Marilyn Monroe's old dresses to wear. And she basically said, screw that. Who did the entertainment industry want her to be? And then how did she just pull away?
Yeah, I mean, Abby Lincoln is really fascinating. It's kind of a hidden gem, I think, for me in making the film. I, of course, had heard, knew Abby Lincoln as a singer in the later years, but I didn't know her earlier work. So it's I think it's a real discovery. So Abby Lincoln, exactly. They wanted her to be in the mold of Lena Horne. So when she started out, she was a singer. She was a chanteuse. She was in these, you know, some early films where she wore the Marilyn Monroe dress. And she, you know, could have gone down that road and probably, you know, faced a lot of the same challenges that Lena did in terms of being able to get good roles. But she was also a singer. And she met Max Roach in the late 50s, and they began collaborating together. And they collaborated on the two, you know, albums that we talk about in the film, the Straight Ahead and the Freedom Now Suite. Mm-hmm. And the Freedom Now Suite, that is when, you know, that was one of the earliest, very overtly political songs you know, from a popular singer before Nina Simone. And what she was singing about in that song, about being African-American, being a woman, about colonialism, this was in 1960, and no one was doing that. And she threw off, you know, that Marilyn Monroe dress and that, you know, glamorous, you know, quote-unquote glamorous Hollywood look, and became, you know, a political activist, where she, you know, sang about these truths in song, and also her physicality was challenged. That, you know, it was Afro. She became, you know, embraced her Afrocentric natural look, which was also very political. And again, this was all, you know, pre Nina Simone. We often hear Nina Simone being the progenitor, you know, being the one who did that, very, that people know, but Abby was doing it even earlier.
And watching her transformation in the film is fascinating. And you really just get a sense of that she just was on a mission and she would not be deterred. I agree. I had heard of Abby Lincoln, but I didn't know the whole backstory. It was a fascinating part of the film. The name of the film is How It Feels to Be Free. I'm speaking with its director, Yoruba Richen. Let's talk about Nina Simone. You have to talk talk about Nina Simone. You point to a specific performance, the Steve Allen Show in 64, and her song Mississippi Goddamn as a real pivotal moment. She wrote that song in reaction to the horrific murder of four little girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. This is an archival clip that you include in the film of Nina Simone talking about her response to the bombing.
First you get depressed, and after that you get mad. And when these kids got bombed, I just sat down and wrote this song. And it's a very moving, violent song, because that's how I feel about the whole thing. It's called Mississippi Blank Blank.
Why was this on-camera performance so important?
I have to just start by saying, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, Nina Simone is one of our great American musical geniuses of any race, gender, or anything. I mean, she just is. So let's start there. And then understanding what she was doing in that song, and not just that song, but we also talk about Four Women, but specifically, you know, Mississippi Goddamn, bringing the anger and the sadness and the frustration of racism and white supremacy that had manifested itself most recently in the killings of the four little girls, and of course in Medgar Evers' killing as well in Mississippi, to a national and international audience was quite extraordinary and quite daring. And to play that song on the Steve Allen Show, you know, a popular, you know, mainstream television program in the mid-60s was really quite incredible, and really brought this these emotions of Black people and anger of Black people, you know, moving past an integrationist idea, but that things were not happening in terms of giving rights, in terms of our freedom, fast enough. And she brought that to a mainstream audience. And I think that's really the significance of her playing that song on the Steve Allen Show.
We all know Nina Simone's a genius now. I'm curious, when you were going through all of the research, how was she received at the time?
Well, she was, I mean, it's true now, right? We all say she's a genius, and look at her, you know, her songs and her impact, but it was very daring. She says in that interview that she received hate letters. She received a letter from the KKK. You know, she received a lot of backlash. She has a song called Backlash Blues. She received a lot of backlash for being as overtly political. I mean, Nina also had a transformation. She started as a jazz, well, initially she wanted to, you know, be a classical pianist. And there's a story we weren't able to include in the film of her being rejected from the Curtis Institute, and turning where she, you know, wanted to study classical piano, and then turning to jazz in, and singing sort of early jazz pop, you know, popular songs, and then making that turn, with Mississippi Goddamn and with her subsequent songs of being a political singer and reflecting the times, as she says.
My guest is Yoruba Richin. The name of her film is How It Feels to Be Free. We'll continue our conversation about the documentary. We still have to talk about Diane Carroll, Cicely Tyson, and Pam Grier. That'll happen after the break. This is All of It, and my guest this hour is Yoruba Richin. The name of her film is How It Feels to Be Free. It will be on PBS Monday night, January 18th at 9 p.m. It follows the trajectories of six women in entertainment, six Black women: Lena Horne, Abby Lincoln, Nina Simone, Diane Carroll, Cicely Tyson, and Pam Grier, and talks about all of the ground that they all broke in different ways at different times. We're up to Diane Carroll, who is so interesting in this film because she really found herself caught between a rock and a hard place. She landed sort of the first Black female lead in a TV series, Julia, where she played a nurse. But for a lot of people, it was considered fantasy by a lot of Black people. You have a clip where Red Fox is just giving her a hard time about the character. How did she navigate this position of being this groundbreaker, this tremendous thing of her leading a show, but then having people criticize the work
for what they think is not telling hard truths.
Absolutely. And again, I think her story we see reflected, you know, we've seen reflected up until, you know, today. I think of The Cosby Show as, you know, also being a groundbreaking show that also was criticized in a lot of ways for not reflecting the truths of Black people in the 1980s. So with Diane Carroll, first off, I think it's important to say that there were Black women who had television programs before her, Hazel Scott, who we talk about briefly in the film, The Great Pianist, had a show. And of course, there was Beulah, and, you know, who played a maid. And so she was really, I think, the first African-American to have a show, a continuing show, you know, that was not where she wasn't playing a maid. Mm-hmm. And Julia was obviously groundbreaking, but it was a fantasy in that, you know, race was, you know, never really dealt with. And we're talking, what, in 1960, in the mid-60s, so 68, at the time when, you know, everything was exploding in terms of, you know, in terms of the civil rights movement and the rise of the Black power and the militant, you know, more militant movement. And none of that was dealt with in Julia. But what she said, you know, in my interview with her and in other interviews, that we were allowed to have that kind of film, that kind of TV show. We as African Americans deserve to have something where, you know, it was a comedy and it was light, and we deserve that as well. And so she was always stuck by that. And the TV show did very well. As well. It was very popular. It was very successful. And, you know, one would think that after that, she would have had more opportunities. There would have, you know, been more shows like that, but, you know, but there really wasn't. But then also we see Diane a few years later take on the role of Claudine in the film, where she plays a welfare mom. Mother who finds love, who has, you know, a slew of kids. But is dignified and funny, mm-hmm. and fights the welfare system. That was also a time where, you know, the welfare rights movement, where Black women had been denigrated from the, you know, Moynihan report, from images of the welfare mom, and Diane Carroll in that role, Claudine, which she was nominated for an Oscar, you know, really portrays a different kind of welfare mother, a welfare mother who is a human, who is not who's not just defined by the fact that she is on welfare. So she, Diane is, I think, brilliant, mm-hmm. was brilliant in her navigating these different kinds of representations. And then, of course, there's Dynasty, where she says, you know, she wanted that role. She wanted that role to be unlikable. She's, you know, a Black woman who is unlikable was something that we had not seen before. And that was a meaty role, of course, that brought her, you know, back into, you know, popular culture and was really a comeback for her.
And also, it was funny, that role also sort of made her an icon in the gay community as well. I want to go back and actually play a clip from Claudine, because it's so interesting to hear. This is actually a scene where the social worker is asking Claudine about a boyfriend who's been coming around. This boyfriend is James Earl Jones, by the way, and he's been giving her gifts, and it's really a very interesting interaction in this scene. This is Diane Carroll from Claudine.
The thing is, Mrs. Price, if something comes out later and I don't know about it, you'll be in all kinds of trouble. So if you've been seeing this man...
Well, what is this? Am I not supposed to see a man? What am I, a damn nun?
No, but if you've been sleeping with a man and he's been giving you things, I'm sorry, but I have to know.
Do you sleep with a man?
Now, that's none of your business.
It's none of your business either.
You're wrong, Mrs. Price. It is our business. This man may be bringing things into your home which you may not be deducting. Now, you know I have to deduct you on those things.
What things? What things, damn it? You have a man come over for dinner, he brings you a bottle of wine. I have a man come over for dinner, he brings me a damn six-pack. Oh, there are two left, Miss Kayback. Would you like a beer?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Price.
I'm sorry, too. I figured it out. It comes to about $1.35. If he brings my kid some soda, that's about 80 cents. Now, with quick figuring, that comes to about $2.15, Miss Kayback. That's plus tax.
You mean to tell me that's all he gives you? $2.15.
How much do you get?
Diane Carroll doing it. Let's talk about Cicely Tyson. when we get to Cicely Tyson, we see, you know, we really see her as someone who makes choices about her roles. She also is a dark-skinned woman, and colorism was and is rampant in the entertainment industry. What did you want us to learn from Cicely Tyson's story?
I think with Cicely Tyson, who, you know, obviously is still working today amazingly at in her early 90s, and so old. With Cicely, we really see the evolution of all that, you know, Lena and Diane had fought for in terms of representation. And Cicely is able a little bit more freely to make choices about the kinds of roles she wants to take and have them be meaty, have them be significant. Rebecca, she plays Rebecca, her breakthrough role of Rebecca in Sounder, which she was also nominated for. You know, one of our commentators, LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, says it so well, that she broke it all open, that she was able to not have that more buttoned up, you know, sort of 1950s, 1960s, a way in which we had to be on screen because, you know, of all those different things we just talked about that we were navigating, but that she was able to break it all open and let that emotion and that dignity, bring that dignity to her character. That was groundbreaking. And of course, the fact of her being a dark-skinned woman. She was, you know, one of the few dark-skinned women who were working as leads in that at that time. And that was, you know, a huge deal.
Pam Grier, you bring Pam Grier into the conversation, and it's just, it's so interesting because it's fun in the film because the film takes a little bit of a different tone when she comes in, understandably. What was different about Pam Grier's career?
Yeah, I mean, I brought in Pam Grier because I really think, you know, her iconic status of the characters that she played in the 70s really set the stage again for a lot of the characters that we're able to be, you know, that African-American women are able to be in Hollywood today. Besides the fact that she was hugely popular and blaxploitation was very popular, those, you know, what we call blaxploitation films. But she was a character that, in those characters, Foxy Brown, Coffee, and many others, you know, she kicked butt. And she didn't take things lying down. She was an action hero. Quentin Tarantino calls her the first action, you know, hero of any race. Again, and she was also those films were also political in a way that we hadn't seen before. In that we had African American characters that were fighting, you know, the system, fighting, you know, the man, cops were community minded. Now, of course, there's a huge critique of blaxploitation films, but, you know, it was a genre in which we were seeing ourselves on screen winning in a way that hadn't been, you know, we hadn't seen before.
My guest is Yoruba Richin. She's the director of the documentary, How It Feels to Be Free. And, you know, it's interesting, as we come up in the film, you have other people sort of bearing witness to this. You have Guillemette Buckley, who is Lena Horne's daughter. You have Samuel L. Jackson, Alicia Keys, who's one of the film's executive producers. Why did you want to bring in, you know, I understand Guillemette Buckley, but why did you want to bring in such modern voices? Like Halle Berry's in the film as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was always important for me to, I always knew I wanted to do that because really what one of the things that I wanted to explore and look at and show is the influence and impact these women have on our entertainers today. I mean, these women set the stage, they fought the battles, both on screen and off screen. And we can really see an evolution to where we are today, where we're in another moment of racial reckoning in all industries, including the entertainment industry. And what are the next steps of the battle. How can we continue to make strides in controlling our own representation? And it was so important to have women like Lena Waithe, who is a creator, and Alicia Keys, who's a, you know, multi-hyphenate singer and producer and activist, to talk about these women and their impact and how they affected their own careers and lay the pathway for their own trajectories in their own careers.
My guest has been director Yoruba Richen. We've been talking about her documentary for PBS American Masters, How It Feels to Be Free, premieres Monday night at 9 p.m. Yoruba, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.